Question number 6818 Reel 3.
General Moulton, Reel 3. Where did you usually live when you were on the China station?
We were most of the time living on board the carrier. The practice in the Fleet Air Arm was, and probably still is, that when the carrier goes to a home base, she flies off, before arrival, she flies off the aircraft who go to an airfield. On the China station, there was only one airfield we had for that, which was at Kai Tak. The result was that when we went up to Wei Hai Wei, where the fleet spent most of the summer months, we got very little flying because the ship had to go to sea to fly off aircraft, with the minor exceptions that one or two float planes were often kept at buoys in Kai Tak Harbour.
So you didn't live ashore in Hong Kong?
We lived at Kai Tak Airfield. There was a Chinaman's house. I say Chinaman, I mean a business Chinaman who'd got quite a large house there, which had been taken over. And the Eagle had rather more aircraft than the Hermes, which was usually on that station. And they built a temporary hutted thing with cubicles for officers to sleep in.
What was the atmosphere of Hong Kong like at that time?
Well, if one makes a simple comparison with today, I noticed when I went out to the Far East in 1968 that Singapore had become rather the business hometown centre, while Hong Kong was a glamour spot. It was just the other way around in those days, and we did have occasional visits to Singapore, where in fact we would be landed at the single airfield there at Seletar, but we always looked at a rather glamour spot, and dull old Hong Kong was very nice, very pleasant.
So there wasn't that much to do off duty when you were in Hong Kong?
Not really, no. Well, there were games, cinemas, one or two luxury hotels. It was, I don't suppose it's changed all that. Well, it has changed a lot, yes.
What about the political atmosphere and expectations at the time?
I think one could say that the 2 years we were there was a bit of a lull. Japanese pressure didn't seem to be as great as it was a few years later. I did once see some Japanese troops, and that was up north when we were visiting. We were close to a railway port close to 100 miles or so from Peking. No, actually, at the end of China, at the end of the Great War, I can't remember the name of that. That port now. It was a coaling. They had some coal mines there. And we went up and visited Peking, take a few days leave there. It's very interesting. But one wasn't very conscious of the political situation. There was one incident when two British naval officers were involved or got caught up in a piracy, which took the usual form of the Chinese piracies, that a steamer would be sailing along, and in the crew somewhere would be a gang of thugs who'd attack the bridge and take over the ship. Well, it so happened they caught two British naval officers. And we were, the carrier was closely involved in getting them out. We flew a search over the coast of the, well, inland, over the sort of marginal area of the Yellow Sea. Which was a sort of large number of muddy creeks and rivers really going up. We navigated as if we were over the sea, because map reading was not on and there wasn't enough map to read by. My flight commander, we were all on the different legs of this search, and my flight commander on the way back was fired at. It was very stupid of them, because there were junks all tucked in among these creeks all over the place, and nobody would have noticed these particularly. They fired at him, and the fighters were sent over to drop a few small bombs, about 25-pound bomb, it's my new. And we were laying on quite a big operation to go and cut them out. The Marines were going to land. I was going to land in a float plane with a machine gun to give them covering fire. But they sent back some people to negotiate that night, and they surrendered all the British hostages, all the British captives, and we left the Chinese government, nationalist government, to sort it out after that.
Have you any idea who these pirates were? Were they just...
They were... One of the armies was being disbanded, now I can remember it. They called them root armies, and I think it was a rather... Could it have been the 19th? I don't know.
Possibly a warlord army that had been incorporated into the nationalists.
I think it was a... Yes, it was a... they were under national government, this army. They didn't want to be... And one of the conditions of their surrender was that they should be reenlisted in the... Whatever army it was, could have been the 19th Root Army. Rumour had it that when they got worried, they said they were marched in onto the barrack square and all machine gunned down, but that's purely gossip.
At that time, the nationalist government was trying to purge itself of warlord troops whom to take them during Northern Expedition.
At the same time, facing the growing threat of the Japanese in Manchuria.
Now, you went on up to Peking. Did you see anything of the Chinese Nationalist Army while you were in Peking or on the way there or back?
No, I don't think I did. They certainly weren't obtrusive.
What about conditions in Peking? Was it peaceful while you were there?
Yes, quite peaceful. Just a big eastern city with certain rather remarkable characteristics of that particular one. It's a very historic city. Well worth a visit.
When you saw the Japanese troops, what sort of troops were they? Were they infantry?
I don't know. It was just about a platoon, and they seemed to be detraining at some station we were passing through. I think we may have got on the train at the same station as they did.
When you were dealing with the pirates, and you were making your plan to cut them out, how are the Marines going to reach them?
I think they were going to send up powerboats up this creek, river. It's rather larger than the name in creek replies. I can show you a few photographs. It was really a sort of cutting out expedition, which was laid on for the next morning.
What did they... Now, you say they shot at the aircraft. What did they shoot at the aircraft with?
Oh, machine guns. They're small arms, man. Someone took a pot shot.
How many of them were there? Do you have any idea what the size of the pirate band was?
Well, they had to be got in among the steerage passengers, so to speak, of quite a small ship. Now, I don't suppose they could be more than, 50 or so. I can find the name of the ship, too, when we saw it.
Had the naval officers been well treated while they were held hostage?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think it was a fairly sort of almost gentlemanly operation. It used to go on up and down the Yangtze quite a lot of this sort of takeover, and I dare say some of the merchant navy officers were fairly used to it. They used to fortify the bridge, you know, on most of the Yangtze steamers.
When they negotiated their terms for handing back the British naval officers and being reenlisted, who actually negotiated with them?
On our part?
Yes.
Basically the captain of the ship.
So presumably they must have been able to speak English.
Yes, it was a Chinese businessman they sent.
He was a go-between then?
Hmm?
He was a go-between.
He'd been captured with the other passengers, you see.
So he was sort of sent off to negotiate.
Whether he went back to ship or not, I don't know. Well, I can't remember now. I've got a photograph of him being hoisted in, and he was picked up by a float plane. That's right. they spotted a small junk or coming off somewhere away from the ship. So a float plane was sent out, and he was got on board the float plane, hoisted in the ship, and there he was.
I think you also visited Japan while you were on the China station.
We had a visit. It must have been in the autumn of 1934. It was several ships from the China fleet visited different ports in Japan. As usual, ship visit courtesy, political ship visiting. The most notable thing was the extreme security that was applied to us. We weren't allowed an order that nobody was to take a camera ashore. No photographs or album that visited Japan. And in fact, while we were there in the inland sea later on, a local Japanese photographer handed in a photograph which he said had been developed from someone's ship. There was an awful fuss about it. In the end, we're pretty certain it was a picture of the eagle taken at Wei Hai Wei, where there was in fact a photographic shop, the Japanese one, which was always looked on as our local spy. I think it was almost certain that he took that photograph in Wei Hai Wei, and that was sort of processed through their intelligence things. Why they did it, I mean, just what that was supposed to achieve, I can't imagine. Made an awful sort of fuss, because the commander-in-chief, old Sir Frederick Dreyer, was the sort of man who would make a would take that and make a fuss about that.
What was the atmosphere in Japan compared with that in Peking and northern China?
I'm sorry, in Japan?
Hmm.
Everyone was really very friendly, except perhaps officials. I was lucky enough to have we were allowed up to 4 days' leave on a foreign station. You can't do much in that. But I was very fortunate in meeting somebody. I was lucky enough to meet an official from the British Embassy at a cocktail party the ship gave
at Kobe.
And as a result, an observer friend of mine and myself, we flew from Osaka to Tokyo on a civilian flight. Had a day or two in Tokyo, visited the military museum, which is a fascinating place to go to. It had all the traditional Japanese armor, tremendous display of Japanese swords and so forth. Then we took a train down the eastern side of Fuji, and when we were about opposite the mountain, probably took a car, I think, and finally went on horseback to a mountain hut at about 7,000 feet, and spent the night there, and with a guide did the last 5,000 feet. Unfortunately, didn't see very much because the mountain was covered in low clouds. From the top, they have lava dust slopes, squeeze slopes of lava dust, and the custom is to run down these, which is fascinating, because you take a long jumping stride and you hit the dust, your foot goes into dust, and you slide on another yard or so, and then you repeat it with the other foot. And so down into the tree area, which I do remember, we were in the sun by then, as being intensely, it was very beautiful indeed, the effect of the light on the trees. One sees something of this famous Japanese art. One sees the sort of conditions which must have baked it. Into a little very small town on the railway where we spent the night in traditional Japanese conditions. The fact that we had the matting beds, and the fact my length caused a lot of amusement, because they put two end-to-end for me. and so on by train back to Kobe. There was some sort of army exercise going on in that era, because there was a group of Japanese army officers in the same hotel. We got a few dirty looks there, but otherwise I can't remember anything but these broad Japanese smiles. On the whole, the impression of the ship was the men were pretty ugly, but the girls were fascinating in the sort of mixture of it wasn't quite European dress. It was somewhere between the two. It wasn't, one of course saw them occasionally in the traditional commando and so on, but they had sort of long pleated skirts and always these brilliant smiles, of course.
So it was just the officials and the military who showed signs of suspicion and hostility, not the population as a whole?
No, I think the traditional attitude of the population in Japan is one of rather good manners and greet a foreigner with a smile. And of course the children, they have this tremendous feeling for children. You know, the tradition was that a little child is dressed very brightly indeed, and as you get older and older and older, so your clothes get more and more muted colours. This is very obvious.
Did you see much of the Japanese Navy when you were in the ports?
Nothing, not at all. I saw nothing, actually. I believe a small party of officers crossed the island to the naval base. There was that one on the other side, and I wouldn't remember the name now. But they were so closely guarded for security. Well, the only thing they really noticed was the extreme security precautions.
Mm-hmm. What about Japanese Navy off the China coast? Did you see anything of them?
No. I'm sure it's rather remarkable now you mention it. Way high way in the summer, we had ship visits from many European. I remember there was a German cruiser came. I think a French one did. I saw Subaltern Marines. I used to do attachment duties as well as fly. One noticed it particularly because at morning colours you have to play the anthems of all the other warships in the harbour, which came quite a long performance.
What about Chinese naval craft?
No, I don't think there were any at Wei Hai Wei. I think there were... I doubt there was very much Chinese Navy at all then. I think have an idea there was a sort of admiral somewhere in the era. But
did you have any official exchanges of courtesy visits with Chinese commanders? Or
I think we must have done. I think this port admiral, or whatever it was, would probably have called. I can't remember it specifically.
I think you also went visiting the Americans.
Well, we would meet them. I can't particularly remember an American ship. Well, we must have had an American ship. I'm sure we played the Star Spangled Banner sometimes with colours. They had their own, well, it mounted to their base at Tsingtao, the ex-German colony. And then probably in the spring of 1935, we visited Manila. And we were very well entertained, both by the British residents there and by the United States Navy.
So the Americans were friendly and...
Oh, very, very.
How did you find the Germans and the French when they came visiting Wei Hai Wei?
I don't think I had any contacts with them. They obviously did the ship visits. I remember the German boat's crews, the German were extremely well turned out, and they put ours to shame, largely because, I think, because they had better tropical rig. We were still the sort of baggy shorts, and I think the sailors wore dark blue stockings on their shorts, and of course, they were obviously... selected some of their sailors for their fine physique, and they had a much more modern look about their tropical rig than our people did, and they did rather put us to shame. When talking about Americans, the American boats, I remember, we always rather admired, the ship's boats, we thought they were very good, better than ours, in fact.
Why was that?
I think because they got on with it. I think we were a bit too traditional in our design.
What features in particular were better?
Well, British, between the wars, we were having great troubles with the internal combustion engine and picket boats and things. they seemed underpowered and tended to break down. The Rodney, my first ship, had a thing which looked like a picket boat with funnels, but they were always breaking down. In fact, I want to go into boats breaking down. I go back to Rodney when they were always in trouble.
Did you visit the Dutch East Indies at all?
Yes, we went to Jakarta. I haven't any particular memories about it. There was at that time a British flying boat flight going through. It had been a sort of fly out to Australia and home, and they had a great deal of trouble taking off, I remember, in Jakarta Harbour. I think they probably overloaded themselves with all their kit and so on.
Did you get a friendly reception from the Dutch?
Oh yes, very, very friendly.
I think you came back to the Mediterranean in 1935.
Yes. We handed over to the Hermes at Singapore just about on New Year's Day 1935. Came back to Malta and took part in the spring exercises with the home fleet. We were in the Atlantic quite a bit. They were doing some Atlantic convoy exercises that year, and I remember flying in those. Then back to Malta, and I think the last time I flew as a naval pilot was in the Silver Jubilee Flypast in when was it? June, I think,
1935. Must have seen some increase in tension in the Mediterranean on account of the Italian activities in Abyssinia. Did you notice anything?
Well, it was going up. Of course, there had been the Spanish Civil War. Am I right in thinking that was before Abyssinia? Haven't got my sequence wrong, have I?
Yes, I think that started in 1936.
Hmm?
I think that started in
1936. I got that wrong. No, in that case, I don't think there was. No, I can't. Because I was a junior officer, all sorts of things may have been going on in his head. On the China station, we used to... Obviously, British newspapers didn't come out. Wei Hai Wei, we got nothing, but we had an arrangement that a long wireless message was taken, a really long one, and about four of us among our duties were to reduce this to about a page of foolscap type to be put on notice boards.
A summary of the news.
Say half a dozen pages of sometimes a bit garbled typescript to try and cut it down to an interesting one page. I do remember, my most acute memory is the constant references to a disarmament conference which was going on at the time.
You say you did your last flight in 1935, and what happened to you then?
Well, one's... when I undertook to serve 5 years, the first tour in the fleet air arm, and I very reluctantly decided to return to general duty after that. Didn't seem to be any future for a Marine. I thought I'd try and get to Staff College, and so I had to get back within a certain age limit to take the Staff College entrance exam. I got back to England in the summer, early summer of 1935. In fact, I was doing a machine gun course, of all things, when the Abyssinian crisis broke. And I and one or two other officers, of course, we were marched into Fort Cumberland, which is part of the Eastney Barracks complex, and told to take charge of an anti-aircraft section. So it's 2 3-inch World War I 3-inch guns. The Vickers Predictor just appeared, and I didn't like this at all. I mean, I thought if I was going to take part in ever seen in crisis, I'd rather take part flying an aeroplane than shooting these guns. However, there it was, and so there we went on to Alexandra.
You say you were called in. Why was this duty given to Marines rather than to Army anti-aircraft troops?
Well, I think I must really refer to you to my short history of the Marines. There had always been a tendency. It really is quite a long and interesting subject. It hit the United States Marines in much the same way, but there were two choices for Marines about that time. One was to defend a naval base, and the other one was to seize a naval base. Now, the British had colonies all around the world, or colonies and dominions, so I suppose almost inevitably the emphasis in Britain was on securing, defending a naval base. In fact, after World War I, the Madden Committee of 1924 suggested the formation of a Marine Brigade, an infantry brigade, but they never got any money for it, while the Mobile Naval Base concept, as it was called, did get a little money. It got a good puff from Alexandra, where it was much expanded, went down to Carter basis, and then, in 1939, the same rivalry developed. There was the, first of all, Marine Brigade. Priority was given to Mobile Naval Base, and so it went on through World War II.
When you were told you were to take command of an anti-aircraft section, had you had any previous experience of this sort of
work? Only in ship's gunnery. Because I had done the junior officer's naval gunnery course. That, of course, was mostly based, and I'd had guns, I'd been responsible for guns in the Rodney and the range. Anti-aircraft gunnery in those days was a pretty hit and miss affair.
What difference did the arrival of the Vickers Predictor make?
It was entirely a very much better method of controlling anti-aircraft fire. It didn't last long, and other methods came in, but it was really the first advance from World War I controlling. I mean.